Let the Galaxy Burn. Narrated by a Border Prince. Angels by Robert Earle. It was almost 40 years ago, but I still remember. Sometimes, though, the remembering is hard. In the warmth of a high summer sun, or in the smog of the inn, surrounded by familiar faces, it seems that it was only a dream, or an old man's tale, grown tall with the telling. But when the wolves came last winter, it was clear as the summer sky over the fields. And when Mary lay screaming in her first labour, the memory was the only thing that kept the fear from freezing me. When it happened, Pasternesh was smaller than it is now, much smaller. There was nothing north of the stream but the shadow of the mill, for all of the cottages and even the workshops were tucked safely behind the stockade. They huddled around the green, their backs to the world, but between their sturdy gables we could see the battle of distant treetops against the wind. The stockade itself was higher back then. It had to be, for we had worse to worry about in those days than the price come harvest time. The Emperor, may the gods protect him, had yet to start clearing the forest hereabouts, and the forest was near. From time to time, lying in our beds, we would hear cries floating through the darkness of the night. Savage cries that were neither human or animal. When they became too much to ignore, the council and the rest of the men would meet on the green. There, amidst the comforting smells of smoke and stew and dung, they would drink and argue for a day or so. Then they would decide to do what they always decided to do, which was to send out a patrol, but always by daylight, and never with much enthusiasm. Sometimes the patrols would return in triumph, carrying with them rabbits or even deer, but mostly they just returned hurriedly. They were fools to avoid finding the enemy before he found us, but one cannot blame them, not really. Which of us wouldn't rather pull the blankets up over our heads and hope for the best? One autumn, the shadow of the forest grew longer. Rumours pulsed along the narrow tracks and open rivers of the land. Rumours of northern sorcery and a hideous new progeny of the terrible art. One of the scrawny, haunted-looking rangers who occasionally drifted through on the road to the city stopped for long enough in the village to frighten us all. He told a tale of lights in the sky, great fiery displays to rival the Borealis, of villages found mysteriously deserted and gutted by fire, of horribly cloven, two-footed tracks in the cooling ash. After he had left, everybody told everyone else that he had been mad, or a liar, and what else could you expect from a ranger? But even I noticed that after this the men of the patrol stayed nearer to home and kept their eyes more firmly shut. They even stopped bringing back game. Then, after Mullins was taken, the patrols from Pasternak stopped altogether. Mullins was a scarred old bull of a man. He had arrived at the village 2 years before, still dressed in his patched halberdier's uniform. And I think that my brother and I were only slightly more overawed by him than our parents were. Even Alderman Fowser was at a loss for words when the old soldier took his hand in a painful white-knuckled grip and allowed the two massive war dogs that comprised the whole of his luggage to sniff his new neighbour's breeches. In spite of his strange manners and Southland accent, Mullins soon became popular in Pasternesh. His hounds brought down many a wild boar, which he would arrange to be roasted for the whole village in return for his fill of ale. When these feasts were finished, apart from bones to gnaw and the dying embers of the fire, he would fill our imaginations with blood-curdling tales of death and glory from his time in the Emperor's great army. Even more welcome was the fact that he was willing to hire any man who needed the coin. A couple of miles to the west of the village lay a derelict way station with a few neglected fields, which Mullins bought for his retirement. Because he always asked for the village's advice, as well as paying their sons to help him, The whole village took some pride in the way that Mullins rebuilt the crumbling walls of the gatehouse and cleared the land that it stood over. It was some small measure of the affection in which he had become held then, that when the old soldier didn't turn up at the village for 2 whole weeks, a patrol went almost willingly to see if anything was amiss with him. Though I was but young then, I will never forget the grim silence with which they returned to their families that afternoon, and the sense of outrage that clung to them, like the smell of the smoke, and the sight and sound of Gustav, the blacksmith, iron-faced and iron-handed, suddenly choking and rushing into his hut. I tried to convince myself that the agony of sobbing we could all hear from within was the smith's wife. The thought of this, the hardest of men, breaking down, was too unnerving. None of the men who went to check on Mullins' farm, then burned it to the ground, ever did tell of what they had found there. Today, all being safely buried in the hallowed ground next to the village shrine, they never will. But over the years, I've managed to piece together fragments of whispered conversations, or the drunken rambling of men quickly hushed by their fellows. Not much, I grant you, but enough to give some idea of the bloody nightmare those men encountered. I know that, amongst other things, they found Mullins at the farm, or at least what was left of him. He had been eaten right down to the bone, but even as he fell, he had not abandoned his weapon. Skeletal fingers locked desperately around the haft of a bloodied spear. Even now the image fills me with a kind of horrified wonder. His dogs were found lying on either side of their master. Their ruined and convulsed bodies bore witness to the desperate resistance they had put up. They had died as they had lived, full of courage and loyalty. Few men can hope for such an epitaph, and my eyes sting even now at the memory of those fine animals. Of the attackers who had committed this foul atrocity, there was scant sign. A few bones, a few fly-encrusted brown stains on the stone of the walls, and the splintered wood of the door. It seemed that their flesh had tasted as sweet to their companions as any other. To witness such scenes at first hand must have been like stepping into a walking nightmare. No, it sounds almost perverse to say it. I thank the gods for it. The horror of Mullins Farm was enough to shock the whole village into wakefulness at last. It was no longer possible to ignore the danger, and all our lives were changed and reordered overnight. There was a meeting on the green the next morning. Nobody drank. The only argument was when Frau Henning, our young farrier's mother, tried to prevent his volunteering to ride to the nearest empire town for help and men-at-arms. But Gulmar's father overruled her tears and protestations with a fervour that was close to rage. He was proud of his son's courage, I think, and didn't want to deny him the chance to prove it. That pride began to turn into a cancerous mixture of bitterness and regret a few short weeks later, fueled by grain alcohol and a nagging wife, and eventually killed him. Of course, we weren't to know that, as we watched father and son bid each other farewell in the clear light of that bright morning. They were alive and together for the last time on this world, and perhaps sensing it, they shook hands as equals, maybe even friends for the first time. Gulmar Henning never made it back, but at least he didn't die a child. As the hoofbeats of the farrier's borrowed horse faded into the distance, we all stood in a long, solemn silence, broken only by the accusing sobs of the boy's distraught and inconsolable mother. Then the discussion began. And incredibly, insanely, it seemed at the time. It was decided to do the unthinkable. We abandoned the harvest. That year's autumn wheat was left to ripen, then wither outside the palisade. A feast only for the teeming birds and vermin. While our golden lifeblood rotted back into the dark earth, the whole village worked at a fever pitch. The great mill wheel was lifted off its pole and wrestled through the gates, leaving a naked patch on the overgrown stone of the wall. Carsten, the miller himself, supervised this piece of necessary vandalism with shrill cries and fluttering hands. As he capered around, he reminded me, despite his fleshy jowls and shiny head, of a hen that has lost his chicks. Even at that age, though, I had the sense to keep the thought to myself, as I did the private grievance that my brother and I would no longer be able to use the grate as our private staircase over the wall into the village. Most of the work was done in the forest, as more trees were felled to strengthen the stockade. But then I was confined to the village with the rest of the children. But even there I could hear the harsh cracks of axes biting into green wood, and the occasional shocking crash of a falling tree. Throughout the next few weeks, the sound of men nibbling away at the edges of the forest became a constant rhythm that we all lived to. Meanwhile, Gorma Henning's mother had taken to haunting the parapets in a painful, desperate vigil. She stood silent above the frenetic activity of the village, gaunt and crow-like, in a widespread black cloak. She finally broke her silence after 3 days with a piercing shriek that sent us all rushing to the wall. My eyes followed the line of her trembling arm as it pointed to the east, and I saw it. There was nothing much, just an orange glow on the horizon. Through the jagged arms of the black forest, the distant flames even looked a little comforting. The fire came from the direction of Grunwald, 30 miles away. And I wondered aloud, quite innocently, and without malice, if they were having a bonfire. I turned to ask my father, but his tight-lipped expression of angry relief silenced me. I left the chill of the parapet and retreated to my bed, confused and afraid. The next day, we began to work even harder. I didn't have much time to reflect on the strange new turn our lives had taken, which was perhaps just as well. My days were spent with cleaning and splitting feathers for a growing bundle of arrows, or spinning the sharpening stone at just the right pace to avoid Gustav, the smith's wrath. My only break from all this was the occasional errand, or, much to my disgust, doing the woman's work and drawing the village's water. Even though the work was hard, I do remember enjoying it, for the novelty made all of this excitement and panic a great game for a child as young as I was, albeit a slightly uneasy one. I couldn't understand why everyone was so gloomy and foul-tempered. Even Stanislav, the brewer, usually the jolliest and certainly the reddest-faced man in the village, snarled at me when I knocked over a pile of hoops he was finding for the smith. Then came the night. Just as winter was starting to tighten its icy grip on Pasternash and all the land around it. When I did understand. I was shocked from my sleep in the steely grey hour before dawn by the awful sound of a man screaming. Screaming and never ceasing. I clambered out of the cot I shared with my brother, still too groggy with sleep to be truly alarmed. When my father burst through the door, half-dressed and crazy-eyed. Even in the gloom, I could see his knuckles were white from the grip he had on his scythe, as sharp and gleaming now as it had ever been. He shouted at my brother and me to get under the bed, but the undercurrent of terror in his voice froze me where I stood. I never heard the like before. As my father charged outside, I saw the other villagers dashing to the northern wall in the torchlight. Alderman Fowser was already high on the stockade, with half a dozen other men, hacking down into the darkness beyond. I was almost as surprised to hear the alderman spitting out such obscene oaths as I was to see the blood that ran from his pitchfork as he pulled it from one of the shadows. My father had his foot on the lower rung of the ladder when he stopped, turned, and bellowed a warning. Over the south wall, with a hideous snarling and squealing, poured a wave of dark, misshapen forms. They clambered over the eaves of the cottages and squeezed through gaps between walls like a boiling mass of gargoyles brought to life by the night's pale moon. When they reached the torchlight sanctuary of the village green, I felt myself shrink at the sight of them. The things were an obscene combination of man and beast, horribly melted and twisted together, but their deformities, far from weakening them, seemed to give them an abnormal strength. Their clothes were ragged strips, shredded and filthy, but the claws lashing at the end of their arms were sharp and bright enough to freeze me. My cry stopped in my gaping mouth. The miller, who stood equally open-mouthed and incredulous in their path, was the first victim of this hellish tide. Without breaking their pace, the twisted demons tore him to pieces with a mercifully brief rending and shrieking. Even as they continued their charge, I saw with a rising gorge shreds stripped from the man's separated limbs being crammed into their fanged, bestial mouths. With a dreadful roar, my father and the rest of the villagers turned to meet this vile onslaught. In the middle of the green, steel met claw in a nightmare of blood and savagery. The men at Pastinesh fought with a burning madness of fear that night, but even so they were no match for this savage breeding and sheer weight of numbers of the enemy. Gradually, remorselessly, the villagers were pushed back to the north wall by the ravenous horde before them. Every man who went down was fallen upon in a hideous feeding frenzy that merely seemed to fuel the enemy's bloodlust rather than sate it. Then, in one terrible moment, two terrible things happened at once. The elder man, our appointed leader, was torn from his perch atop the wall by a second slashing swarm of monsters. And, infinitely worse, my father collapsed under a crushing blow. His opponent, a writhing bundle of fangs, claw and muscle, roared in delightful triumph and lunged forward to feed. There was no bravery in what I did, for without fear to overcome, there can be no real courage. It's true that I had to plunge through the wave of horror, which engulfed me to seize a rock and run yelling defiantly at the beast thing. There was no fear, though, only a sort of divine rage at the abomination before me. Turning to face me, the beast let out a dreadful baying laugh. It towered above me, so close that I could smell the reek of it and see with crystal clarity the single drop of saliva roll down one curved yellow fang. Still, in the face of its laughter, and in the face of its power, I raised my feeble weapon and leapt towards its claws. My blow never landed, nor did it need to. For in that dread moment, knowing my weakness and knowing my faith, the gods heard my raging prayers and struck for me with a piercing whine and a blinding flash of light brighter than any storm. The corrupt beast in front of me burst apart in a spray of blood. The struggle around me stuttered into silence as men and monsters alike looked in wonder at the astonishing blinding death of my enemy. Then, the angels appeared. There were four of them, one on each wall of the village stockade, and they were both beautiful and terrible. They were clad as great armoured knights, and they moved as if they had the power of giants contained within them. Their huge, shining armour was of a strange and wondrous design, the sweeps and curves of it coloured in hues of blue and green. In their hands, they held bizarre weapons, swords bearing teeth, ornate carved metal wands, incomprehensible bundles of steel pipes which gleamed dully with a strange menace. One of their number wore hugely distorted gauntlets, vast hands made of some worked metal which sparked and crackled with bound lightning. He lifted the flaring blue gloves above his armoured head and closed the steel fingers into a fist. It was the signal to begin. In total silence and in perfect harmony, three of the armoured figures plunged into the squealing mass of demons below. The killing began as soon as their vast iron-shod feet hit the ground. Fang swords squealed and screamed like cats on a fire as they bit down into flesh and bone. They spat great gouts of blood and flesh high into the black vault of the night, and the shrieks of their victims added to the din. I felt a curiously warm drizzle began to fall, and casually licked a droplet from my lips. It had the salty, coppery taste of fresh blood. Suddenly I was bent double, racked and spasming, seized by a fit of vomiting. Through my tears I saw the terrible blue fire of the steel fists. The being that wielded them strode among the shadows of his enemies with a hypnotic grace, a terrible dance of death. As he twisted and swung, the massive burning hands snatched at heads, limbs, torsos, muscle and bones split asunder at his divine touch, into hideous steaming wounds. The stink of burning carrion started to drift through the village. At first, the corrupt pack of abominations teeming within the stockade had reeled under the wrath of our saviours. They died like animals in a slaughterhouse, shocked and bewildered, until an enraged roar cut through their stupor. The chilling cry was returned from another beast thing, and then another, until it echoed back and forth from a score of deformed throats. It rose to a savage crescendo, and once more, the demons flung themselves into the attack with a terrifying ferocity. But as the fiends hurled themselves towards the blood-spattered angels, a staccato shriek from above suffocated their war cry. Hands clutched desperately over my ears. I looked up and saw the fourth of our saviours, still standing atop the wooden stockade, thrown into sharp and flickering relief by guttering flames. The bundle of steel pipes he held whirled and flared as they spat burning lances of fire into the charging forms of the enemy. The living were lifted, torn into bloody ruins and hurled to the ground. The dead were shredded further, their remains beaten deeply down into the wet soil. Jaws snapped open in rictus howls of agony, inaudible over the awesome noise of their execution. Still the demons fought, despite the lines of holy magical fire that sliced through them like a new scythe through ripe corn, despite the fresh meat afforded by the rising piles of the dead. Despite everything, they fought back against the angels. Their bloodlust drove them to total annihilation. Claws and fangs cracked and splintered on celestial armour. Divine weapons ate eagerly through verminous hides into the twisted bones beneath. Tainted blood splashed, stinking and steaming into the cold night air. It was a massacre. Finally, some semblance of realisation must have come to the last of the few survivors from the warband, and the last of the monsters tried to flee. I watched the panic, the sheer terror in their rolling yellow eyes with grim satisfaction. Barely able to understand what I had witnessed, they rushed past the angel with the blazing steel fists, leaving two of their number slashed and dying at his feet, and leapt for the stockade. There was to be no escape from the divine wrath of our saviours. Burning spears chased them, found them and ripped them apart in arcs of blood and fire. The sizzling gore splattered across the splintered timber of our stockade in glistening sweeps and curves. I stared into the grisly patterns, my mind a shock blank, and suddenly I imagined I could see the bloody face of Gulmer, the young farrier, staring back out at me. I began to shake and gag with dry heaves. My ears still shrilled and rang painfully from the noise of their deafening weapons. For a time, I could do nothing but crouch and heave and cry. It was a long while before I realised that the battle was over. The angels stirred amongst the great banks of corpses, silent and still, in the gloom, like terrible statues. Even then, covered in gore and stinking of burnt flesh, they were beautiful. For one long moment, we stood together, angel and boy, in the midst of the carnage. Then, as silently as they had appeared, they faded from our sight and were gone. I like to think that I was the only one who saw the star rise from the forest that night. It was no more than a silent, distant flash of light, and I would have missed it too if I hadn't looked up from the well at precisely the right moment. As I carried the water back to bathe my father's wounds, I marvelled at the glimpse I had been afforded of their celestial chariot. And even now I still smile to myself when some travelling sage or other tries to tell us what the stars are. It was almost 40 summers ago, but still I remember. When the wolves came last winter, the memory gave me the courage to find and destroy them in their own lair. And when Mary lay screaming in her first labour, the memory gave me the strength to break the taboos and deliver my son. Now, as the voices of my people fade away, and all I can hear is the ticking of the death watch in my ears, I remember the events of that singular night, and I am not afraid. For I know that in the darkness that I soon must face, the gods will send their angels to watch over me again, and this time, they will not fade.